Accession number 27347, Reel 19.
We brand Reel 19.
We came to a town which we recognised as, I forget now whether it was Perth or Dundee, one or the other. Errol was in between. And we decided that we'd had enough. So when it came to a stop, we detrained. And of course, all hell broke loose then. There were home guards and police all over the place. Apparently we'd been seen at the last marshalling yard, and they were all gathered at the marshalling yard at the place we were going to. And as we got out, we were threatened with bayonets left, right and centre. And I know how the corporal in the Home Guard had a fear they don't like it up them, because I was terrified with all these naked bayonets prodding us from all angles. Anyway, they took us to the local... They marched us through the streets, first of all, to the police station. And, you know, the population thought that we were real prisoners of war, and they were booing and hissing, and I think they would have strung us from a lamppost if they could. Anyway, we were taken into the police station, and the police sergeant was a treat. He got us to tell him exactly where that bicycle was, because it was outside his area, and it was one-upmanship. Oh, he loved it. He wanted all details of it. And if he eventually phoned up to say, have you found your bicycle yet? And we were plied with strong tea with lashings of sugar in it. And was that right? It must have been Dundee, because the sergeant said his daughter worked in the marmalade factory. That's it. And that they were never short of sugar. Him, the policeman in charge of the station, he said, we get enough sugar to so that it comes out of your ears. I remember that expression. Anyway, we were returned to the returned to our camp at Errol. And had a good night's sleep after it. Another thing that we did was practice in a rubber dinghy out in the Firth of Tay at night. We were taken out in a rowing boat in our flying kit. Mae West had to jump over the side, inflate our dinghy in the water, get into it, and we had to paddle around till dawn. We were told we mustn't come ashore till dawn. That was quite an experience, being in a rubber dinghy overnight. Mind, it was calm there in the Firth of Tay. It would have been very different in open water. We had had experience in Blackpool Baths by jumping off the top board in flying kit and inflating a dinghy, but it wasn't anything like being in the Firth of Tay. It was colder in the Firth of Tay, and you felt helpless and a long way from any salvation. if you'd needed help, you couldn't have had it in the Firth of Tay.
How did you manage that? How do you inflate your dinghy? How do you get into your dinghy?
Well, that was what we were learning. There's a ripcord on the dinghy, and doing it in the dark is so different to doing it when you can see everything. Getting into the dinghy is quite difficult, especially a one-man dinghy where there's no help to get you in. In the in Blackpool Baths, we'd had experience of both the one-man and the three-man dinghy. When we pulled our air gunner into the three-man dinghy, he had a sharpened pencil in his Mare West, and as we pulled him in, the sharpened pencil punctured the three-man dinghy, and it went and we were all left in the water. So we made a point in future of always carrying pencils. We cut pencils in half so that you only had a stub pencil, and always inserted it point downwards. It's little things like that which are lifesavers, and proved the value of practice like this.
Was the dinghy attached to you at all, or was it free?
The dinghy was attached to the underside of the parachute, which for a pilot you sat upon, so that it was there because the parachute was attached to you with the parachute harness and would go with you into the water, and then you had to pull it off. There were press stud tabs to unfasten it from the parachute. The observer had a dinghy in a valise, so had the air gunner, so that they had that attached to them with a cord.
When you were doing the practice, were you actually watched to make sure you actually got into the dinghy from the rowing boat, or did they just leave you at that point?
Oh, the rowing, there was a chief petty officer in the rowing boat who was prepared to give you a shove if you didn't want to go.
But would he watch for you that you'd done the right procedure and you'd actually got into the dinghy before he left?
I don't think so. No, I think we were on our own from then on. There were three of us, pilot, observer and air gunner. We had whistles. We could have attracted attention if we'd needed it. If one of us had gone missing, we would have been immediately blowing our whistles. I think he stayed within reasonable distance until he was sure that we were all in.
Any other things that you were doing while you were there?
Yes, the dummy torpedoes. Now, it was also a training station for Wrens who were training to be aircraft fitters. And under the watchful eye of a chief petty officer, they were doing major overhauls, major services on Swordfish. And there was one Swordfish which needed repiping on its fuel system, and the Wrens repiped it. And the chief petty officer, I think, was in the naffy drinking coffee. That Swordfish was test run on the apron, and then it was given to me to fly, to go off to do an exercise, the fuel system had a fuel cock which had a three-way cock. It had main tank, emergency tank, which was up in the gravity position above in the top wing, and both, and off. And they'd repiped this incorrectly. They'd got they'd connected the emergency tank to the main tank. They'd connected, I forget which anyway, they'd misconnected them. And I did the run-up on both to make sure that there was no blockage, and taxied onto the runway and took off. And I was about 30 feet up when the engine cut. The perimeter was about 100 yards away. There was a bus, a double-decker bus coming along, and I saw that I was about to hit it, I think. I tried to bounce the aircraft over the road by sticking the nose down while I had speed, sticking the nose down to bounce it over the perimeter wire, which was barbed wire on an angle. And being February, the ground was soft, and I didn't get the rebound that I'd expected, and my undercarriage caught the top strands of the wire, flipped me over on my back, and I travelled upside down, tail first, through a hedge on the other side of the road into a field, a ploughed field. When I hit the ground, the top wing was ripped off. Being an open cockpit, my head was close to the ground. A whole shower of ploughed field, ploughed earth came up. The connection between the main tank and the gravity tank had been ripped out, and I was upside down, so that the gravity tank, sorry, the main tank was open-ended, and started to pour 160 gallons of petrol over me, and I was trapped inside. Fortunately, on the bus, there was a flight sergeant, so I'm told, I never saw him, who saw what had happened, realised the problem. He dug like a dog in the earth, which was fortunately loose. It wasn't frozen, it was moist soil. And reached inside and undid my harness and got me out, and dragged me away from the aircraft. Saw that all my clothes were soaked in petrol and that I'd passed out. I thought I was on fire, because once you get it in your eyes and your nose and your lungs, petrol burns, and I thought I was on fire. And I passed out anyway before he got me out. But he dragged me a decent distance away and then stripped the clothes off me and covered me with his greatcoat. And by that time the blood wagon had got there and they took me to sick bay. And he collected his coat, and I never even found out who he was, but everybody told me it was a flight sergeant in the RAF. I wish I'd been able to meet him. They took me to sick bay. And the first thing I remember is coming round with a WAF nurse with her arm round my shoulders and a mug of warm milk. I suppose that was to counteract the tetraethyl lead in the petrol. I was just beginning to realise where I was when some clot flying round the circuit with a dummy torpedo on pressed the wrong tit, and it came through the roof of the sick bay and landed about 8 feet from me on the other side of the bed, and buried itself about 4 feet in the concrete. The concrete floor was about 3 inches thick, and of course it just went straight through it. And I remember looking at this, and I'm told I passed out again, but my friends told me that all I did was bury my head in the bosom of this waff and this. I'm not quite sure which one it was, but I had such a peculiar dream of being in a heaven where I was attended by marvellous people, marvellous women, very lightly clad. Anyway, I came round and surveyed the damage and realised I'd had two escapes. I wondered what the hell else was going to happen. Anyway, nothing else happened. So that was quite a day for me.
Had you had any injuries at all? Really, apart from inhaling the petrol?
That... I've still got a mark there, which...
That's on your bridge of your nose?
On the bridge of my nose, yes. Apparently I banged that somehow. Maybe it was when I hit the top of the fence and went upside down, because I had soil in my hair, and I don't know when it happened. I was too concerned with other things.
It sounds like it's quite a rugged aircraft, though, the Swordfish, to survive that type of a
crash. Oh, yes. Well, it was a write-off, according to the instruction at the time. It was a write-off, but apparently it was stuck at the back of the hangar, and eventually they reconditioned it. And it went over to Canada, and it was sold for crop spraying at the end of the war, and it was then bought by the Strathallan Museum, and they partly renovated it and ran out of funds, and then British Aerospace took it over and reconditioned it completely, and that's it at Yeovilton now.
And that's the aircraft that you crashed in?
W5856. And it's the one surviving Swordfish which is flying in this country.
Was there an investigation at all about the crash afterwards?
I understand there was, but by that time I'd moved on and I wasn't called for evidence. But I understand that the the Chief Petty Officer was was blamed for it, and he lost his chieftaincy and demoted to petty officer.
At the time where you were at Errol, were you actually crewed up with an observer and a
not an then, no, no. That came after Errol, when I went to Inskip. And at Inskip, we met up with, I think it was 15 pilots, met 15 observers, and then you had to crew up with somebody, and you spent about 6 hours with them, or less if you made up your mind quicker. But at the end of 6 hours, you had to say yes or no. And then when a pilot and observer had crewed up together, the air gunner was introduced, and you had your choice of air gunners, and again you had 6 hours to make up your mind, 6 hours of flying together.
When had you moved to Inskip? Because you'd gone to, I think you'd gone to Errol in January, hadn't you?
Yes, we went to Inskip in, I forget, it must have been early April.
Where is Inskip?
About 8 miles inland from Blackpool. I'm just trying to remember when it was we went to Argus to do our deck landing. Oh, it was after we'd crewed up. That's right. Yes, we went to Inskip to crew up. I crewed up with Bill, my observer. He was just like a brother to me. From the instant we met, we just hit it off together. He too had had a father in the First World War who'd been badly wounded. He'd grown up in the family to be patriotic. He'd done the same thing as I had. He'd gone to he'd got his 11 plus, he'd gone to a secondary school, hadn't the money to go to university, although he'd qualified for university, went to night school and went to serve his apprenticeship as a draftsman with a firm making tanks in Methil, Fifeshire. And we'd had a similar background and similar standards, similar interests. He'd always been interested in flying, as I had. So we hit it off from the start.
As an observer, had he started out to train to be a pilot and then been remustered as an observer, or had he started out as
an observer? He'd started out to be a pilot, but he'd failed. They said his reactions weren't quick enough. But his education was such that he made a damn good observer. Actually, he would have made a good pilot too if they'd given him a longer chance. In later occasions, we agreed that he would climb over and sit on my lap and take control. And we did that a couple of times. Not many observers would have risked climbing over. He could have landed that plane. I know he could. He could have got us back. If something had happened to me, he would have got us back. His other actions later on proved how competent he was.
You say that you met up and your personalities gelled,
yeah,
because of a similar background. How does the actual process of crewing up? Do they just literally put you in a room together and
yeah, sort of? we got to know each other. We shared a Nissen hut. We lived together. We spent our spare time together. We went to lectures together. But it was a case of just milling about in a room, getting to know each other, until you said, right, let's go flying. And we flew about, as I say, 6 hours, but we knew before that, we knew almost right away that it was okay. So then we decided upon an air gunner. And the one that appealed to us, he's a Welshman, Taffy, naturally Taffy, but he had the highest marks as an air gunner. On the range he proved himself, and he could dismantle his gun in the dark and put it together in the dark. He was very good on his Morse. But the first time we flew together, he got permission to take off on his Morse code, got permission to take off. And we took off and we were met with a hail of red Veery lights. So we did a circuit and came in and landed again. And we were accused of taking off without permission. And he'd got permission from another airfield. He'd used the wrong crystal or whatever it was. Anyway, that was his first mistake. And then I'm trying to think what his second mistake was. Oh, yes, he left his trailing aerial out when we came into land and nearly decapitated somebody on the main road. This wire whistled along with lead balls on the end of it, this trailing aerial. So we decided we'd had enough. And by that time, most of the air gunners had crewed up. But the youngest one of all, who looked like a baby boy, was left, Johnny Hopkins. So we took Johnny Hopkins, and that was it. We found that he too was like the other two of us. We just gelled together.
Had he been left because of his youthful looks, do you think?
Yes. Babyish looks. He was so young. He was only 16.
Had he lied about his age too?
Oh, yes. And he'd borrowed his brother's birth certificate to get in.
You know, when you were crewing up, you mentioned, obviously, you know, about the first air gunner you had, that he had the highest marks on the range.
Yeah.
Did you know of each other's skills at that level? Would you know if, an observer was a good observer, or an air gunner had good marks, or whether you were a good pilot, would they know that, or would that be...
It wasn't allowed between pilot and observer, but between pilot and observer and air gunner, yes, because he wasn't commissioned. It's another example of the Navy. Officers could do no wrong, and they could get all the information, and the poor old air gunner had no choice at all.
Could you tell me now how the various roles within the plane, what everybody has in there, what they do, the lines of demarcation, who does what, and what those roles are?
Well, it's as simple as this. The pilot goes where he's told to go and has to get you there. The observer has to know where you're going and how to get there and give instructions for courses and so on. He's got to know where north is at any given time. He's got to know where you are at any given time, and he's got to know where you're going to at any given time. And the air gunner was there to keep a lookout, to keep in touch whenever he was allowed to use the radio, he was to have the colours of the day on his Vera pistol at any time. And that's about it. And, of course, anybody had to be able to do anybody else's job.
Would the observer also look at the radar?
It depended. The observer would generally always do the radar, rather than the air gunner, but they were interchangeable, so that if ever the observer was sick or wounded, the air gunner could take over, and vice versa. It wasn't really possible for the pilot to do either of their jobs, because he couldn't climb over and get in the back. No, he had his own responsibility.
Dandy, no.
Bill, my observer, because he had always wanted to be a pilot, agreed with me that we should see if he could take over from me, because he'd been a mountaineer, he was good on climbing, and he climbed over to sit on my lap and take control on, I think, at least three occasions when we were over the Irish Sea, and he could fly the plane. He could.